From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the story of Madam C.J. Walker. The daughter of slaves, she built a business empire marketing hair products for African-American women, and then turned her wealth into philanthropy. She counted among her friends W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. We talk with Walker's biographer and great-great-granddaughter, Alelia Bundles. Also, in the 1930s, the Harper Salons flourished in the U.S. and Europe, founded by another entrepreneur, Martha Matilda Harper, a Christian Scientist, feminist, and former servant. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Harper. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Coast Guard said today that it's calling off its search for survivors from a Japanese fishing vessel that was sunk in a collision with a U.S. Navy submarine last Friday. A Coast Guard spokesman said the Navy will continue to search for 9 people, including 4 Japanese high school students. The Navy confirmed today that 2 civilians were at the controls of the USS Greenville when it surfaced, colliding with the fishing vessel. Navy officials said the civilians were closely supervised and their presence should not have affected the sub's performance. President Bush says he wants a review of all policies regarding civilian activities during military exercises. President Bush is preparing for his first foreign trip as president to Mexico. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports it's a way to ease into foreign policy.
President Bush says while some look south and see problems, he sees potential. He told State Department officials he looks forward to hearing some fresh ideas from Mexico's new leader, Vicente Fox.
Mexico has seen a new birth of freedom, and trade is creating hope and economic progress. The door is open to a closer partnership with the United States.
President Bush is to visit Fox's ranch for an informal summit that will touch on some difficult issues. They're likely to discuss immigration, trade, and drug trafficking. Mexico wants to see the United States change what it sees as a patronizing annual review of drug-fighting efforts, the so-called drug certification. The White House says Bush is interested in reforming the system. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Researchers have discovered another contaminant in Great Lakes fish. The Great Lakes Radio Consortium's Lester Graham reports.
Scientists have found traces of chemical flame retardants in salmon in Lake Michigan. The EPA says the chemicals seem to affect human health in ways similar to PCBs. States around the Great Lakes already advise limiting fish consumption because of those contaminants. John Manchester is a researcher at the University of Wisconsin. He says, like PCBs, the flame-retarding chemicals are stored in fatty tissues and bioaccumulate. That is, they're passed on in ever higher concentrations as one fish feeds on another.
They have been taken up all along the food chain before they finally reach the salmon. That means they're quite widespread throughout the lake.
Manchester says it's likely that fish in the other Great Lakes are also contaminated. The flame retardants are used in electronic circuit boards and other plastics. They're released into the environment when old computers, TVs, and other appliances are dismantled. For NPR News, this is Lester Graham.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 19 points to close at 10,891 in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 1.1 billion shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 61 points, or 2.4%, but closed at 2,552. This is NPR News from Washington. Federal prosecutors in New York confirm that they've opened a criminal investigation into former President Clinton's pardon of financier Mark Rich. The investigation is expected to focus on bank and telephone records, tracking donations made by Rich's ex-wife to the Democratic Party, Hillary Rodham Clinton's Senate campaign, and the fund to establish the Clinton Presidential Library. Rich and his partner, Pincus Green, fled to Switzerland 17 years ago after being indicted on more than 50 counts, including income tax evasion, fraud, and illegal trading with Iran. Lowe's Cineplex has become the latest big movie theater chain to file for bankruptcy. The company will be acquired by an investment group led by a Canadian conglomerate. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Lowe's has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, which will allow it to continue operating while it reorganizes its debts. Under the bankruptcy deal, the company will be acquired by a group of investors led by Onyx Corporation. Lowe's, which is partly owned by Sony, is the nation's second largest theater chain with 365 theaters. In January, it announced plans to close nearly a third of those. 10 theater chains have filed for bankruptcy in the past year. The industry went through a spate of overbuilding in recent years, taking on huge debt in order to build bigger and more luxurious theaters. With so many screens, a lot of older theaters are being shut down, and analysts say many more will have to be closed before the current shakeout is over. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
In stocks today, the broad-based S&P 500 index gained 10 points to close at 1326. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, featuring the Unlimited Advantage, brokerage service that lets investors plan, invest, and bank. 1-800-MERRILL or askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. In 1914, few women were even allowed to drive a car. But Madam C.J. Walker not only had a license, she drove a Model T bought with her own hard-earned cash. Madam C.J. Walker was born to freed slaves. She was a washerwoman who went on to found a hair care and cosmetics empire. The first female black millionaire, Walker gave thousands of dollars to charity, supported anti-lynching campaigns, and testified before Congress for the cause. Her daughter, Alelia Walker, ran a popular literary salon during the Harlem Renaissance, which attracted artists and writers, including Paul Robeson and Langston Hughes. Alelia Bundles is my guest. She's the great-great-granddaughter of Madam C.J. Walker. Bundles is a former Washington deputy bureau chief for ABC News. She's just written a history of the family matriarch, On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker. Hair was a highly charged and political issue in the 60s when Bundles was growing up. I asked her if she ever felt conflicted about Madam Walker's reputation for marketing hair straighteners and other beauty products, which helped black women look white.
That was a little problematic for me because many people did associate her with that. And at that point, I was ambivalent about her. I was much more fascinated with her daughter, Alelia Walker, who had been the toast of the Harlem Renaissance and who gave great parties. But it was through the next few years, because there was quite a bit of focus on hair, and among white kids and black kids. You know, white kids were letting their hair get long and frizzy, and black kids were letting their hair go natural. So in whatever household you were in, there was probably a battle going on with one generation to another. But it was really into my late teens, early 20s, that I began to reexamine Madam C.J. Walker, and I began to learn that hair straightening was not her main objective. In fact, she was trying to help women have a better hygiene regimen, a better grooming regimen, and she really liberated black women from some of the old-fashioned ways that they were approaching their hair. And she helped them move beyond the scalp disease that was plaguing so many people, because hygiene was very different. In the late 19th century, early 20th century, women only washed their hair once a month, and that meant they had horrible scalp disease. Her regimen was more frequent washing, apply an ointment that contained sulfur, a centuries-old healing curative for scalp disease. So she really helped women in that way.
Let's go back to her early history to set the record straight. Madam C.J. Walker was born Sarah Breedlove, born to freed slaves, I think about 5 years after emancipation. What was the family economic situation?
She was born in 1867 in a little hamlet of Delta, Louisiana. Her parents were absolutely poor. They had been slaves on the Birney Plantation, and that was an area in Delta, Louisiana, across the river from Vicksburg, that had been totally decimated by Sherman and Grant. So the life was just a scramble for them. They were very, very poor, and the crops of 1867 and 1868 were horrible, so they had no money. And when Sarah was born 2 days before Christmas in 1867, that was probably the only Christmas present that the family had. They were just eking out a living.
Did Sarah work the fields?
As a little girl, yes. As all children who were living in the South during that time, as soon as you could walk, you were part of what was going on. Your mother had to take you to the field because there was no child care. There was no place to leave you. So children would learn to carry water to the parents, or they would help pull some of the cotton off the cotton bowl. So children very early on learned how to work.
She ended up living with her sister. What was her situation there? Did she have to work for the family?
Right. When Sarah was seven, her mother died first. Her father remarried and then died apparently shortly after, so that before she turned 8 years old, she was an orphan. She moved in with her sister and brother-in-law. Her sister was about 14 years older than she. And she always described the brother-in-law as cruel. And that, she never elaborated, but that says to me there was some kind of abuse going on. So the life was very difficult for her. And, of course, they expected her to work. And by 10 years old, most black girls were working, either as if not in the fields, they were working as laundresses. So she probably was working all the time by 10 years old. And at that point, they moved across the river from Delta, Louisiana, to Vicksburg, Mississippi. But by the time she was 14, she said, I married to get a home of my own, to get away from my cruel brother-in-law.
It sounds as if her her marriage, if not solid, was okay. She produced a daughter, which was your namesake,
right.
Your grandmother, Lelia.
Right.
And then by the time she was 20, Sarah was widowed. How'd she make a living at this point? It seems as if this is another, that her story is one of tragedy and incredible resilience over and over again.
Over and over again, yes. She just kept bouncing back. And most black women in that era were working. It was very different. This percentage of white women who were working, who were married, is much lower than the percentage of black married women who were working. So like most people that she knew, she had to make a living for herself, and she was working as a washerwoman, probably picking cotton some parts of the year. And after her husband died when she was 20 years old, this was in 1888, she moved to St. Louis. Fortunately for her, she had three brothers who were living in St. Louis, and they were barbers.
Is this what got her into the hair business?
Well, I will never really be able to definitively say her brothers being barbers got her into the hair business, but it's certainly, as a historian and as a journalist, I take a little bit of a leap of faith and believe that it must have influenced her, at least planted the seed.
Now, she did have problem with her hair.
Problem hair.
and apparently a problem that was pretty common at the time. Her hair was falling out. What was going on there, and what did she try as a remedy?
Well, I have to, especially when I'm talking with students, with young people, I say, you know, you're not going to believe this, but 100 years ago, people didn't have bathtubs in their houses, and they might have taken a bath once a week at the public bath. They didn't have running water. They didn't have central heating or electricity in most instances around America. And Sarah Breedlove was one of the people who was in those kinds of circumstances. She, through what kind of old wives' tales, women believed that they should only wash their hair once a month. People who lived in rural areas might not wash their hair at all during the winter because they might fear that they would get colds. So over time, they developed really horrible scalp disease. And their hair began to fall out. So if you think about what dandruff is like now, and you just multiply that by about 1,000 times, and think about what your scalp would feel like and how much you would scratch your scalp, that created huge problems. And she was losing her hair as a result.
Were there hair care products for this problem, to deal with this problem?
There were some things on the market, but remember, this was an era before the Federal Drug Administration had passed some of these bills that prevented people from making wild claims about what their products did. So Madam Walker experimented. At that point, she was still Sarah Breedlove. She experimented with some of the products that were already on the market, but many of them had chemicals, or they used things like ox marrow and all kinds of wild ingredients that weren't particularly helpful. But there were other products very similar to the one she developed, and it's a very basic formula that's still sold today. It was an ointment called petrolatum mixed in with sulfur, which was the curative, and then the sulfur was masked with a violet perfume extract and coconut oil.
How did she market the product? Was it a door-to-door business like an Avon lady?
She did go door to door initially selling the products, and then as she really got her sea legs, she began to gather women as she traveled from town to town at the she'd always go to a Methodist church and a Baptist church. She wanted to make sure she covered all the bases. She would gather women and she would talk to them not only about her products but about pride in themselves and economic independence, and she would talk about what was going on with African Americans in other parts of the country. So in a time when there were no movies and no radio and no TV, when she would come to town, she was the big event. And she once told one of her sales agents, she would do slideshows and show pictures of different black schools and her own manufacturing factory, her own factory and her own homes and those kinds of things. And she said to one of her agents, it's not the product, it's getting people to come. Once you get them to come, then you can sell them anything.
What other projects did she develop?
Madam Walker initially sold five products: her vegetable shampoo, her wonderful hair grower, which was the petrolatum including sulfur, something called Tetter Salve, which healed dandruff, Temple Salve, and then Glossine. And Glossine was just a very light ointment. And that was the ointment that was used when she used the hot comb to straighten the hair. They would apply the Glossine and then comb the hot comb that was heated in a lantern or over an open flame through the hair.
So this was where the hair straightening
This is where the hair straightening came from.
In.
Right.
Was hair a politically charged issue even back then, before the turn of the century?
Hair was a politically charged issue even in the mid-19th century, where some people said, this is the way God made you should stay that way. And things get a little jumbled up, I think, because during that era, it was a Victorian era, it was a very proper era. Women, African Americans, were becoming more urbanized. People were moving to the cities. They wanted a more sophisticated look. But if you consider that most people were not really grooming their hair, and so people had lost many of the traditions, the African traditions that beautified them. So they were not caring for their hair in a way that made women feel attractive. And if they were also going bald, you can understand that they weren't focused on straightening hair, they were focused on having hair. And then I think we went through a period into the 20s where the flapper look and the Josephine Baker fix, very straight, slicked down hair, evolving into the 30s, 40s, and 50s, where straight hair was just what everybody did. And it meant black women couldn't go swimming because their hair would go back. And so people approached hair as if it was supposed to be straight. And then it really took the civil rights movement and the reexamination of the position of African Americans in the society for people to become more comfortable with natural hair. And, you know, there was something that Madam Walker said in 1918. A white reporter had ridiculed her and called her the de-kink queen, and she was very offended by that. And she said in response, "Let me correct the erroneous impression that I claim to straighten hair. I grow hair. I want my people to care more about their grooming. And I predict that 10 years from now, you will not see a kinky head of hair, but it will not be straight either." Now, I read into that something that maybe everybody else doesn't read into, but I think it sort of anticipated where we are today.
What did the packaging look like?
I found the packaging very interesting. I did a lot of research looking through old black newspapers and compared the advertisements used by the Walker Company and other companies. And it was very interesting that in the 1890s, you would see a lot of advertisements for hair care products directed towards black women in black newspapers. And many of the advertisements were from white-owned companies who were really kind of exploiting the insecurity that black women felt about their hair and about their skin, so that you would see an ad that had a before picture where someone looked like a pickaninny and had bad skin, and then you would see a drawing that was the after picture, after you used their product, a product called Kinkella, for instance, and there would be a person who looked like, who was a mulatto. You knew that transformation could not be made, nor should it have been made. Madam Walker, I think, was very clever in putting her own image on her products, because she was saying to women, I'm a very African-looking woman, and you can look as I do. You can have the long hair that I have. She used advertisements that showed a before picture where her hair was patchy and then her after picture was her long hair. And it wasn't, it was kind of bushy, you know. It was, she was showing, I think, her own beauty. So she was smart enough to use her own image. And it's almost as if she said, not only can you look like me, but maybe you can be rich like I am as well.
So it's kind of a self-empowerment image. It wasn't,
so.
Wasn't aspiring to some kind of white ideal of beauty.
No, I mean, I think we can't dismiss that the tyranny of beauty in America was impossible for most women to achieve. Most women were not going to look like the Gibson girl, who was the popular look of the 1890s, the wasp-waisted Gibson girl with the hair cascading on top of her head. Most women weren't going to look like that, whether they were black or white. But just as we have certain styles now where people feel they want to look a certain way, everybody can achieve it, and people are often striving to be something that they can't really be.
I'm talking with Alilia Bundles. She's the author of On Her Own Ground, a new biography of Madam C.J. Walker, who was Alilia Bundles' great-great-grandmother and one of the first and most successful African-American entrepreneurs. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alilia Bundles. She's the former Washington Deputy Bureau Chief for ABC News. She has a new book about her great-great-grandmother, Madam C.J. Walker, the African-American hair care entrepreneur and philanthropist. The name of the book is On Her Own Ground. Madam C.J. Walker, part of her empire was also building hair salons, which really were a rarity then, hair salons for black women, that is.
Well, hair salons, I think in general, the cosmetics industry, the hair care industry in a commercial sense was just evolving in the early 20th century. Madam Walker, Helena Rubinstein, Elizabeth Arden, and Annie Pope Turnbow Malone were all pioneers at a time when the commercial interest had not become interested in these kinds of products for women. In fact, you know, there was a real prohibition. Painted ladies and ladies who paid too much attention to their grooming were looked down upon. And this was a business that was not of interest to most men. And I think that's how these four giant women were able to develop the industry and to become pioneers.
Now, there were plenty of other entrepreneurs, as you say, making big money at the turn of the century. There's Fuller Brush was going strong. Lydia Pinkham's patent medicine tonic had earned her hundreds of thousands of dollars. Avon had already gotten big. What distinguished Madam C.J. Walker from these other direct sales magnates?
Well, she was definitely focusing on a market that was a market they were ignoring. And she was taking her products to women who had not been told they should be pampered. She was giving them pampering and paying attention to them and telling them that they were beautiful. And also, very, very important, helping them become economically independent. I mean, she had her first convention of Walker sales agents in 1917, around the time Mary Kay was born. Madam Walker was already giving prizes to her sales agents, to the people who had sold the most products, to the people who had brought in the most new agents, and also to the agents who had contributed the most to their churches or to their community organizations. She wanted her agents to use their economic clout to make a difference. So before there were political PACs, Madam Walker was already creating a large group of women coalesced around their financial independence to make a difference as lobbyists, in a sense.
So she was really promoting business development.
She really was. I think she was a total visionary. Madam Walker was a visionary because she saw the potential power of African-American women and saw that they could make a difference. At the 1917 convention, the agent sent a telegram to President Woodrow Wilson to urge him to make lynching a federal crime, and that would be very similar to the hate crimes bill that we've been looking at in more recent years. During the next convention in 1918, they sent another telegram to the president urging him to honor the rights of black soldiers who were fighting in France during World War I.
Madam Walker earned her name as a philanthropist primarily for two big bundles of money she gave towards the YWMCA and also the NAACP's anti-lynching movement. I believe she also gave to African-American colleges and other smaller grants to institutions. Was she accepted by the black leadership of the time, by the black political elite, or did they look askance at this woman marketing cosmetics?
There was a range of response to Madam Walker, but I think anyone who looked askance at her initially was finally won over and respected her because she was really one of the only African-Americans who had the money to make a difference with her political perspectives. Other people might have been outspoken and pushing different political agendas, but Madam Walker could actually put some money where her mouth was. Now, she did have initially a bit of a set-to with Booker T. Washington, who at the time was the most powerful black man in America. And Madam Walker very much wanted his respect and wanted his endorsement. But he did look askance at the products that she made. He had lumped her products, her hair grower, in with some of the products that were manufactured by white-owned companies that were making these wild claims about straightening hair. He was very uncomfortable with that and thought that that would hold African-Americans up to ridicule. So he dismissed her initially without really understanding what she was doing. And when she appeared at his 1912 National Negro Business League conference, he refused to allow her to speak. And on the first and second day, and on the third day, she just pushed her way to the front and told him, "Surely you are not going to shut the door in my face." And then he listened to her speech with some caution, but the next year he invited her back as the keynote speaker. In terms of some of the other members of the leadership in the African-American community, people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Ida B. Wells Barnett, some names that we're not as familiar with today, James Weldon Johnson, Mary Church Terrell, Mary Burnett Talbert, people who were in the leadership of the National Association of Colored Women and the NAACP. Those people really did respect Madam Walker. And especially after she moved to New York in 1916, she became a part of the leadership and contributed her money and helped support the causes.
Alelia Bundle's new biography is On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Corrine, Corrina, where you been so long? Corrine, Corrina, where you been so long? Ain't been no loving since you've been gone. Oh, Corrina, where'd you stay last night? Dear Corrina, tell me where'd you stay last night? Came in this...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Confessions of a Shopaholic, a novel by British author Sophie Kinsella. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Langston Hughes called her the joy goddess of Harlem's 1920s. Coming up, we hear more about Alelia Walker and her mother, the legendary African-American entrepreneur Madam C.J. Walker. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography about another entrepreneur who built a beauty empire in the 1930s for men and women who like to be pampered.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's return now to our interview with Alelia Bundles. Her new book is On Her Own Ground, a biography of her great-great-grandmother, the black hair care and cosmetics entrepreneur, Madam C.J. Walker. The daughter of slaves, at 20, Walker was a widow with a young child. She worked for 2 decades as a washerwoman before going on to found a beauty empire. She used her wealth to support the political causes of her friends Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, and was also active in the NAACP's anti-lynching campaign in the early 1900s. Did Madam Walker's activism against lynching and testifying in Washington for anti-lynching legislation get her in any hot water politically? Earn her any kind of name as a troublemaker?
Well, you know, I found this very interesting that if we think of the climate almost like during the Vietnam War, when anybody who spoke out against the war, anyone who had some different perspective than the Nixon administration, for instance, was put on the enemy's list. Well, there was something very similar going on during World War I, where Woodrow Wilson and his Secretary of State were rather freaked out by what they considered Bolsheviks, or people who were subversives. And being a subversive just meant that you were a little militant or you were a little outspoken and you did not agree with them. Well, Madam Walker was very militant about the anti-lynching legislation that was being proposed, and she was very militant about the civil rights of African-American soldiers. And as a result, when she met with other African-American leaders, both in her home and in public places, she was watched by a black spy who was working for the Military Intelligence Department of the War Department.
Did she know?
I don't know that she knew at the time, but I think there were some hints because she applied for a passport to go to France. She and a number of other African-Americans wanted to go to Paris to observe the peace talks at Versailles after World War I, and her passport was denied. Coincidentally, she and her attorney, F.B. Ransom, happened to be very close to Emmett Scott, who was the undersecretary for Negro Affairs at the War Department. And apparently Emmett Scott had seen the file on her and suggested in a letter to her attorney that her name was on file as a Negro subversive.
Madam C.J. Walker died in her 50s when her business was at her height, and she left it to her daughter, Lelia, your grandmother, to care for the company. She didn't have much of a head for business, but she did end up as one of the leading figures in the Harlem Renaissance. What role did she play in Harlem culture? Was she a benefactress?
Alelia Walker was called the joy goddess of Harlem's 1920s by Langston Hughes, the poet and author. I always loved that word. And she was the person who first attracted me. We share the same name. Our birthdays are a day apart. I was always fascinated by her because she had known people like Duke Ellington and Zora Neale Hurston and Countee Cullen, the poet. And I wanted to know much more about her. The story that many people told is that Madam made the money, Alelia Walker spent the money, but it was really more complicated than that. And in On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker, I have really tried to develop her, give her more dimension so that people could see early on she was very involved in the business. But as time went on and her mother spoiled her a little bit more and she became more the heiress than the businesswoman, that her life began to evolve. And like I think many children of larger-than-life figures, she was trying to find something that was her own so that she would not always be compared to her mother. And the 20s seemed to be the perfect time for her because she did have more money than most people, and she had beautiful homes, and it was a decade of parties and a decade of music and literature and culture. And she was the one who often provided the venue for people.
You mean she sponsored parties and kept them fed and right, happy and connected right, people with other people?
Exactly. She had parties, and she had a beautiful townhouse in Harlem, a beautiful 4-story townhouse, and she turned the top floor of that townhouse into a salon called the Dark Tower. And there were always events there. There were teas, there were parties, there were after-hours parties, there were jam sessions. And then her house in Irvington, New York, her mother had built a beautiful mansion that's still standing. It's a National Historic Landmark called Villa Loiro. And at that home, Alelia would have weekend parties. I once interviewed Alberta Hunter, the blues singer, who in the 1980s was playing downtown in New York at a place called The Cookery. And when I interviewed her, she described playing the organ at Villa Loaro, this organ that was piped all through the house. And she even told me that Alelia Walker had a great singing voice. I mean, Alelia Walker had this wonderful, flamboyant, outgoing, gregarious personality. People loved her and loved being around her. And remember, she had grown up in St. Louis right in the beginning of the ragtime era. Where they lived in St. Louis was where Tom Turpin and Scott Joplin and other people were playing ragtime. So she, I think, in her bones, she had always been able to feel the music.
She died relatively young. I think she was 46. And the business had really faltered since Madam Walker's death under her heading. Was the consensus that she never lived up to her mother's expectations?
I think that's true. Now, but the business itself was really run on a day-to-day basis during the 20s by F.B. Ransom, who was Madam Walker's attorney. And he did everything he could to hold the business together. But where sales in 1919, the year of Madam Walker's death, had been $500,000, which would be about $5 million today, by 1930, a year deep into the Depression, the sales had dropped to 130,000. Well, that was because the people who had been buying the products no longer had jobs. They couldn't work. So it really wasn't Alelia Walker who created the demise at that point of the company. But she really wasn't as interested in the business as time went on.
She's your namesake, Alelia. Growing up, were you told, oh, perhaps you'll turn into a toast of popular culture like your grandmom, or don't turn out like your grandmom? She did kind of come to somewhat sorry.
Yes, she did. End. She did have a sorry. She did have a very sad ending because she had become accustomed to the wealth and all the trappings and, you know, both the good and the bad that comes along with that. And I just think my grandfather said that she had a stroke, and my grandfather said she knocked herself out because she wanted to be knocked out. And I just think she saw nothing but poverty ahead, and she couldn't really face that. That's what she had known as a child, and it was just too much for her to deal with. But, you know, I was really fortunate growing up that my mother was wise enough not to overwhelm me with Madam C.J. Walker and Alelia Walker. I was never told be like this or don't be like that. I was really encouraged to follow my own dreams. And I was allowed to discover these women on my own in my own time.
Were you pressured by your mother to follow her into the family business?
No, my mother was a wonderful lady, very, very smart. And she had been pressured to go into the family business. I think there just wasn't really any discussion. And she was the fourth woman to be an executive of the Walker Company from her family. But by then she knew that because I think she had been forced to go into it. I think she enjoyed certain aspects of it, but she really wanted her children to follow their own dreams and to develop their own interest. And I just find it very ironic that my interest was always writing. At 8 years old, I had my first story published, and I really got a thrill from seeing my byline, and I got a thrill as I learned that I could write and describe scenes and, you know, make myself tingle by writing, that I developed my own interest as a journalist, and I was telling other people's stories. But all the time, I was really burning to tell this story and to understand the story of my family. So the birthright and the inheritance that I had appeared to be abandoning finally came back to me.
Alelia Bundle's new biography of Madam C.J. Walker is On Her Own Ground. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alelia Bundles. Her new book, On Her Own Ground, is a biography of the African-American hair care entrepreneur, Madam C.J. Walker. Her empire included hair and cosmetic products, as well as beauty schools and a network of hair salons. Even early on, a visit to a salon was about more than just hair.
There's, you know, quite an interesting culture of women talking with each other in the beauty shops. And really, many of the beauticians who, anybody over 50, most of the black beauticians were either trained at the Walker Beauty School, the Apex Beauty School, or the Poro Beauty School, which was the company that Annie Malone had founded. But I have very fond memories growing up and being in the beauty salon and listening to the ladies, you know, as they gossiped and told stories, and as the man came through from the church selling fish on Saturdays, and as all the music was playing in the background with people like Theola Kilgore and Aretha Franklin. So there's quite an interesting culture, and there's a lot of scholarship going on right now about the history of the hair care industry. There's a young woman named Tiffany Gill at Rutgers who's writing about beauty shops and politics, that in places like Selma, Alabama, after the bombing happened, where African Americans were afraid to meet sometimes in churches, that they would meet in beauty shops because no one suspected that anything would be going on in a beauty shop. So they have, in a sense, always been very much a center of the community.
Oh, that's interesting, that merger of politics and hair care.
Absolutely.
Runs through your whole story.
Exactly. I mean, that was Madam Walker's message, and I think people lost, much of her story has been lost, and I think that is, if I can help restore an understanding of the combination, not of the hair care and the money that was made, and that the money was used for philanthropy and political activism.
Growing up, what did you know about your grandmother? Did you hear stories?
I definitely heard stories, but I think I began to feel these women organically. When I was 3 years old, my mother and father and I moved back to Indianapolis, and we spent a couple of months in my grandfather's apartment, and I happened to be sleeping in the bedroom of my late grandmother. And in that bedroom were all kinds of things that had belonged to Madam C.J. Walker, my great-great-grandmother, her daughter, Alelia Walker, as well as my grandmother, their photographs, clothes, jewelry. So I began to sense the magic of these women even at a very early age.
Did you have an image of what her business was and what she represented? Because there was an idea that Madam C.J. Walker sold hair straightening products.
Right, right. Well, when I was growing up, my mother was vice president of the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company. So I would go to her office, and I was, you know, always sort of fascinated by the adding machine and the typewriter, and played with that. I wasn't focused very much when I was young on whether she was making a hair straightener or not making a hair straightener. It was actually in the 60s when I wanted to have an afro, and I was a senior in high school in 1969, and that then became somewhat of an issue. But before that, people weren't really debating whether black women should straighten their hair or not straighten their hair.
So the hair wars raised their specter over your family in the 60s?
Absolutely, absolutely. By that time, my mother was still vice president of the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company, and my father was president of a competitor, Summit Laboratories, and they made chemical hair straighteners. And my father really liked my long hair. I think most daddies do like their daughters in long hair, and he was really opposed to my idea to get an afro, and he said, well, the boys will never look at you again. Which was, you know, that was not nice of my daddy to do that. But my mother, having the wisdom of mothers, took me straight down to the Walker Beauty School and proceeded to have the students there develop this big Angela Davis-sized afro for me. So I was transformed right there at the Walker Beauty School.
In the course of researching the book and writing it, did you find out anything that you felt you might not want to include in the book, given that you're writing about someone, Madam Walker, who's pretty almost a popular culture icon, and she's your great-great-grandmother. This is family.
Right. Well, I really wanted to tell the truth. It was very, I had read so many errors and mistakes and found so many myths and misconceptions about her that I wanted to set the record straight. And I had a very important moment in my life. In 1976, when I was at Columbia in graduate school, I had started writing a paper about Madam Walker. And I went back to Indianapolis for Christmas break. And my mother was very ill. She had lung cancer, and we knew that she wasn't going to live much longer. And I remember sitting in her hospital bed and telling her that I was discovering some flaws, and I was finding things about divorces and lawsuits and things that were something other than the triumphs and the achievements of Madam Walker and Alelia Walker. And I said, you know, Mommy, what do I do about these things? Do I include this and do I include that? And she looked at me, and she really had so little energy at that point because of, she'd been going through chemotherapy. And she looked at me and she said, tell the truth, baby. It's okay to tell the truth. And that really freed me up. It meant that I had permission to tell the story as I found it. And I think if I didn't want to gloss over it because I wanted Madam Walker to be real, because her story is more inspiring to me, if people understand that she's a human being. There are other women who want to achieve things in their lives, and if they were to see a person who was flawless, then there would be no possibility. There would be no, they would not believe that they too could achieve the kinds of things that she did.
Alelia Bundles, I want to thank you for talking with me today.
It's been a great pleasure.
Alelia Bundles, her new book is On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker. Here's Alberta Hunter with Fats Waller on organ, recorded in 1927. It's from the box set Rhapsodies in Black, Music and Words from the Harlem Renaissance.
Call my baby my sugar. I never may be my sugar. That's why my sugar is so confectionary. Funny, he never pleads for my money, but when he feeds me on honey, he gets his needs every time. I'd make a million trips to his sweet lips if I was a bee. He's sweeter than any candy to me. Oh, sugar, I never cheat on my sugar, 'cause I'm too sweet on my sugar, that sugar baby of dictionary book. That little word is sugar. I call my baby my sugar. I never may be my sugar. That's why my sugar is such a little lollipop. Funny, he never pleads for my money, but when he feeds me on honey, he gets his needs every time. I make a million trips to his sweet lips if I wanna be, 'cause he's sweeter than any candy to me. Oh, my little sugar, sugar, I'll call my baby my sugar, sugar, I'll never maybe my sugar, that sugar baby of mine.
Alberta Hunter and Fats Waller from a 1927 recording. Coming up, a review of a biography about another beauty business pioneer. This is Fresh Air. Madam Walker's fantastic success in the beauty business was paralleled by the careers of several white women at the turn of the century. There was Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden, and a woman whose name is no longer a household word, Martha Matilda Harper. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of the first biography of Harper called Martha Matilda Harper and the American Dream.
It's February. Need I say more? Nature looks gray and dead, and so do I. That's why it was a lift to imagine walking into a Harper salon circa 1930 or so, painted white and staffed with operators wearing pseudo-nurses' uniforms. The Harper salons specialized in massages, facials, and shampoos meant to stimulate blood flow and tighten the skin. For 2 hours, a customer would be smeared head to toe in patented Harper hair tonics and creams. No cosmetics were pushed, no permanents or dye jobs offered, and customers pretty much styled their hair themselves. But when they left a Harper salon, women and men would be aglow. Once as ubiquitous as white gloves, Harper beauty products were carried by the major department stores, and at the height of their popularity by 1930, there were some 500 Harper salons in the United States and Europe. Customers over the 70-odd years that the Harper salons flourished included Susan B. Anthony, President and Mrs. Coolidge, Danny Kaye, the Marx Brothers, Irene Dunne, Patriarch Joe Kennedy, and daughter-in-law Jackie. During the negotiations of the Treaty of Versailles, a fatigued Woodrow Wilson even patronized a Harper salon in Paris. The woman responsible for all those radiant complexions was Martha Matilda Harper, and she's the subject, at last, of a biography called Martha Matilda Harper and the American Dream. Author Jane R. Plitt is a business professor and entrepreneur. Nothing against those two professions, but you can tell that Plitt is more accustomed to writing business plans than prose. The dull title of this biography hints at what's to come. Plitt's writing style is about as bland as a stick of beige pancake makeup. No matter. Harper herself is such a spunky character, and her story is so amazing, that even the lackluster prose of this biography doesn't do much damage. And to give Plitt her due, while resurrecting Harper's life from the dustbin of history, she also provides an interesting mini-history of the American cosmetics and beauty industry from the turn of the century through the 1940s. As I learned from Plitt, Harper pioneered the retail franchise system. In a way, we have her to thank for transforming the face of retail America into strip malls full of Domino's and Kentucky Fried Chicken outlets. Harper also invented the first reclining shampoo chair and pushed organic products in her salons. Harper's quintessentially American Horatia Alger story began in Ontario, Canada in 1857. Born into a poor, large family, Harper was basically sold off into servitude at age 7 by her horrible father. She worked as a household servant for the next 25 years and would have remained one were it not for a few lucky breaks. First of all, as Plitt's copiously illustrated biography shows, the young Harper had a head of hair to rival Rapunzel's, floor length, lustrous, and crimped. When Harper went to work at age 12 for a Canadian doctor who was interested in herbalism, she picked up the formula for a tonic that made her tresses even more tremendous. About a decade later, Harper boarded a boat for Rochester, New York, with 60 silver dollars and the tonic formula in her pocket. There, she was introduced to Christian Science and the women's movement. The rest of Harper's life is history, forgotten history until Plitt's biography. In Rochester, Harper used her savings to open one of the first public hair salons in the U.S. When her salon took off, Harper was influenced by feminism, Christian Science, her own working-class consciousness, and her longing to create the family she never had, to hire former servants like herself and offer them franchises to set up Harper salons across the country. That's the most thrilling aspect of this biography, the whole sisterhood is powerful angle. Plitt quotes former Harper girls who recall the pride they felt in their self-sufficiency, and you can see that pride exuding from their faces in the photos in the biography. Wouldn't you know it, though? Romance brought down Harper's sororial empire. At the age of 63, Harper married a charmer, 24 years her junior. He eventually took over the company, put it in the hands of managers, and by the time Harper died at age 93, the end was near for her salons, too. I guess the all-too-familiar lesson of Harper's remarkable life is hair today, gone tomorrow.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Martha Matilda Harper and the American Dream by Jane Plitt.
Goodness gracious me. I'm so excited, I'm so delighted. There's a reason for my hey-a-ty, my hotty-hotty hey-a-ty. Goodness gracious me. Looky, 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 here comes Cookie walking down the street. Looky, 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 I call him Cookie, cause he's sweet. Looky, 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 here comes Cookie, what a lucky break. Looky, 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 I call him Cookie, cause he takes cake. When he's near my lips say oh, my heart says ah, tra-la-la. When he kisses oh, it's TNT for two. Looky, 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 here comes Cookie, what a fix my tie. Just a little angel playing hooky, from heaven on high on my sweetest pumpkin pie.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Walking down the street. Looky, looky, I call him Cookie, cause he's sweet. Ooh, looky, looky, here comes Cookie, what a lucky break. Looky, looky, I call him Cookie, cause he takes a cake. When he's near, my lips say oh, my heart says oh, tra-la-la. When he kisses oh, it's TNT for two.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Island Books Division, publisher of Losing Julia by Jonathan Hull, a novel set during World War I and today. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, film director Oliver Stone. His films include Wall Street, JFK, Nixon, Platoon, Any Given Sunday, and The Doors. Join us.
You know the day destroys the night. Night divides the day. Try to run.